For the last 30 years, Stephen Walt has watched American and world politics. He's a foreign policy expert and a historian of the Cold War. He visited the University of Wyoming as part of the Phi Beta Kappa Visiting Scholars Program, and he joined me to discuss how the current political climate is different from the Cold War.
The fundamental difference, it seems to me, is that in the Cold War, the United States was faced with a genuine peer competitor, a country that was not as economically powerful as we were, the Soviet Union, but it was a continent-sized superpower. It had a lot of military power. It had an ideology that attracted millions of sympathizers around the world in other countries, people who were confirmed communists, a real genuine rival. And there isn't such a state like that today. Russia today is a pale shadow of the former Soviet Union. The United States has a 17 trillion economy. Russia's economy is less than 2 trillion. So Russia, although the relationship is now quite troubled in various ways, is not the kind of rival that we faced back then. What we face instead are a bunch of weaker powers, but in some respects, troublesome weaker powers, and North Korea is a perfect illustration of that. North Korea is, by most measures, largely a failure, but it does have now nuclear weapons, which makes it extremely difficult for us to deal with and very difficult to put any meaningful pressure on.
International security and foreign policy are sort of experiencing a unique moment right now where I think a lot of people are maybe more tuned in than they have been in the past. They're paying attention. People are keeping up with what's happening with North Korea, China, Russian attempts to influence American politics. What are you, as an expert, most closely watching?
That's a great question. I think over the longer term, I'm worrying mostly about whether or not the United States can retain its current set of strategic partnerships in Asia. So our treaty with Japan, our relationship with South Korea, repairing a badly frayed relationship with the Philippines right now, and then hanging on to the ties we have with, say, Singapore, with Australia, and continuing to build a more cooperative relationship with India. So I think that over the longer term is extremely important, and I worry that we have taken a number of steps, withdrawing from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, insisting that South Korea pay for a missile defense system that we wanted them to deploy, and other things that have frayed the relationship. Trump had a rather contentious phone call with the Prime Minister of Australia, which didn't help the American image there. If the United States is worried about the balance of power with China, then we're going to need allies in Asia. We can't be in Asia without partners there. And anything we do that starts to undermine those relationships, it seems, is not good for us long term. In the short term, I worry about continuing to fight on in Afghanistan, where we really have no prospect for a meaningful victory. I worry about continuing to get dragged into nation building in parts of the Middle East where we have no idea how to do that, because I worry that that's going to distract us from what, to me, are bigger problems down the road.
You've been monitoring foreign policy and the United States' place in the world for decades now. You have a long view of where we've come from. And I think every moment in some ways feels pressing. Is there something fundamentally different about this moment that we're in right now?
The one biggest difference, and it's the obvious one, is I don't think we've ever had a president who is as skeptical of a lot of the relationships and practices that the United States has followed really since World War II. Whether or not that's right or wrong, people can disagree with. But he is an outlier, as are a number of the people sort of politically associated with him. And how that plays out, to some degree, remains to be seen. I think the other thing that I am struck with, though, is that in some respects, it's the demise of expertise, and even expertise inside Washington. This is somewhat paradoxical because, there are more think tanks there now than there ever were before. Their bureaucracies are bigger. There are more trained experts who have master's degrees and PhDs and things like that. But then if you look in Congress, and if you look in some other key positions, these are people who actually don't know very much about foreign policy. We also have fewer and fewer members of Congress who ever served in the military and have any real expertise in that, cannot be as well-informed critics or well-informed just questioners of military policy because they didn't serve themselves and they haven't really studied it. So I worry that we still have this very ambitious international agenda where the United States is going to have its fingers in lots of different places. But oddly enough, the people who have to make the key decisions there don't know as much as predecessors did, as much as Eisenhower did, or the elder President Bush, or Brent Scowcroft, who was Bush's, you know, right-hand man, national security advisor, most of the secretaries of state that we have had. When you bring the president of ExxonMobil, who's a smart guy, good at running a giant oil and gas company, but pretty clear didn't understand very much about foreign policy or how to run it, it seems to me you're asking for trouble.
One thing that's also different, at least in the past 9 or 10 years, and certainly in the past years since the election, Twitter and social media has entered into sort of a new role in foreign policy. President Trump uses Twitter as one of his main ways of communication with the public and now with foreign countries and foreign powers. What kind of lasting impacts do you think that can have?
It's a great, great question. And I mean, the most obvious thing is that Twitter and other forms of social media have further accelerated the speed with which things happen. And the ability also of people to get unmediated information, whether it's in the form of pictures or videos, when something happens. So when a hurricane hits Puerto Rico, you don't have to wait for the New York Times or your local TV station to put something up there. You go on Twitter, somebody will embed in, you know, a 15-second video showing you what's happening in Puerto Rico after the hurricane hits. And of course, anything a politician says, wisely or unwisely, can immediately be spread all over the world. If you say the wrong thing in Twitter, suddenly others can retweet it and you have enormous amounts of explaining to do. And that speed with which this is happening, I think, is maybe qualitatively different. The second thing that it does, apart from removing some of the gatekeepers, including, you know, people like yourself, responsible journalists who could decide what stories needed to be covered in what way, is that it allows politicians to sort of take action, and Trump is a perfect example of this, to weigh in on issues without necessarily consulting their staff, without having a conversation in the Oval Office. What should we say about this? How should I respond to it? And that's not something politicians have tended to do in the past. They've wanted to be very controlling in their message. Donald Trump, for good or ill, got to be president in part because enough Americans were attracted to this kind of direct, apparently honest, I don't look or sound like a real politician kind of approach. And I think his Twitter profile or persona was part of that. Whether that works in diplomacy remains to be seen. I think the early evidence is not encouraging, but who knows?
There's sort of a collective anxiety that I've witnessed, lots of think pieces coming out in various publications about whether or not American democracy itself is in jeopardy right now. Do you share that anxiety?
Yeah, I do. I think a whole series of things are underway that trouble me a little bit. I mean, obviously, the degree of polarization that has happened where because we have a proliferation of media outlets, people now can listen to the news that they like and the people that they agree with and read the magazines that share their view and gradually become convinced that that's really the only worldview that has any validity. This is true on the right. It's true to some degree on the left, I think, as well. And so instead of being a country that is part of all one big conversation, one big family argument, if you will, one big family Thanksgiving dinner, we now are having separate conversations with the people that we already agree with. And we increasingly see those who disagree with us as wrong, maybe even evil, maybe even un-American. And that, I think, is very corrosive to our politics. Second, gerrymandering and other forms of electoral abuse, if I can use that term, have created far too many safe seats in Congress. And so the congressional elections, the key election is the primary in many places, not the general election. And of course, that means it attracts the more extreme politicians as well, because you win the primary by being pure and ideologically fervent and pretending not to be a real politician. And then you run the general election and you win because it's a red district or it's a blue district, whatever. So you end up with a Congress that's filled with people on extremes, not enough people in the middle who are willing to compromise, do deals, do things for the good of the country as well. I think you put both of those things together and you end up with a democracy that, you know, doesn't pull together often enough, but rather is constantly at war with itself.
How do you get people back around that table?
If I had an answer to that, I could write a different book and sell a million copies. I think it's very hard. One could argue that what it is going to take is some sort of genuine national emergency that pulls people together, and that's a horrible thing to wish for. That things have to get so bad that everyone sort of sobers up and says, "No, we really have to start doing things differently." It may have to be the sort of, a moment like what happened at the end of the McCarthy period, where suddenly sort of McCarthy went too far and people began to stand up to the bully and stop that. It, I think, does require also a willingness on all of our parts to do a little bit less talking and a little bit more listening, including deliberate efforts to listen to people you disagree with. So I try to read more than one newspaper, and not necessarily newspapers that reflect my particular worldview, whatever. I follow people on Twitter who every tweet they put out I find infuriating, but I still want to know what it is they're saying. And every now and then, you know, when I read them, I go, well, that's not necessarily wrong. I should think more about that. And some of that at the local level, you know, sort of people who can, you know, take a deep breath and listen to folks that they disagree with on a local issue, whether it's school board or, you know, environmental management or whatever, and try to recognize that most people have a set of beliefs, have a set of information, and just calling them names and pretending that they're idiots is not going to persuade them, and also is a way of sort of reinforcing your own biases, and in some cases be reinforcing your own ignorance.
You are a political realist. Is there any glimpse, though, or any spark of optimism that you can find in this moment?
Well, I think a naturally sort of optimistic person, even though I tend to see a lot of international politics in a rather competitive fashion. I have several sources of optimism, at least about the United States. The United States is still an extraordinarily fortunate country. We have a providential location here in the Western Hemisphere. We have no enemies nearby. There are no countries with nuclear weapons anywhere near our soil. We have still the world's most productive economy. We have a rich continent still filled with natural resources. We have the world's best system of higher education. We have been better than any other society in the history of the planet at assimilating people from other parts of the world and making them successful Americans. Dozens of top 10, top 20 companies that were founded by immigrants and whatever. So there's a lot going for this country, and we still have a very innovative sectors of the economy in a variety of places. Almost any country in the world would like to trade places with us, and we ought to get up every morning and remember that, and then go out and say, having said that, we're not perfect, and there's some things we can improve, there's some things we can fix, et cetera. So I think we have all the potential, right, to do very well in the world and do very well for ourselves, and it will be a tragedy if through a series of self-inflicted wounds we don't do that.
Stephen Walt is the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He visited the University of Wyoming as part of the Phi Beta Kappa Visiting Scholars Program. Thank you so much, Stephen.
It's a pleasure talking with you.